there was a point of contention a little bit in this divorce. Baumgartner alleged that Costner told the kids about the divorce on his own terms via a Zoom call when they had requested to do it together in person. So wanted to see, do clients ever ask you any advice on talking about the subject with their children?
Having been through a divorce and in obviously deal with my clients' divorces over the years, if there's a mental health professional involved in the family, a counselor, a pastor, maybe family therapist, whatever that's you can reach out to and get guidance from, I always encourage people to do that because it's a personal decision. There's no legally correct answer of what you do and how you tell your children that you're going through a divorce.
Your hosts have earned a reputation as fierce and effective advocates inside and outside of the courtroom. Both partners are experienced trial attorneys who have been board certified in family law by the Texas Board of Legal Specialization.
Thanks for tuning in to For Better or Worse, a Divorce podcast. This is where we provide you tips and insight of how to navigate divorce and child custody situations in the state of Texas. So I'm Jake Gilbreth. I'm joined by my law partner, Brian Walters. And we're also joined today by our marketing director, Katie Justice. And this is for our first episode in a new quarterly series where we are going to start talking about pop culture, celebrity news, and how it ties into family law. So for this episode, we are going to break down the Kevin Costner and Christine Baumgartner divorce, which takes place in California, but we're going to obviously talk about it in how it would play out or analogies that we can make to a divorce in Texas, Brian and I being Texas lawyers. But we're going to discuss our own insights and experiences handling some types of these complexities that you see in this case and how it would relate to Texas family law. So Katie's here. She's going to help us. Katie, being a lot cooler than me and Brian, is going to help break down the background for us. And then we'll go from there.
First of all, has either of you watched the show Yellowstone?
Oh, man, I'm going to get in trouble because I'm going to say I've watched it and it just didn't do it for me and my wife. We've tried a couple of times and the creator or producer of it, I find him a very interesting person. I've just never got into Yellowstone. So I guess cue all the hateful comments on that. That's me personally. What about you, Brian?
It's a big deal in the Walters household. My wife in particular is a big fan. But yeah, the creator is like, I think he's an Austin guy, right? So yeah, he's done a lot of, like I said, it's actually probably my second or third favorite thing that he's done. He's done some other stuff that I think is better, but it's also beautiful scenery. Especially now that it's actually filmed in and around Yellowstone, where it used to be filmed in Utah mainly, but it's light entertainment. Can't take it too seriously.
I was a big fan.
Well, I'll try again. Sarah and I do, whenever we watch TV series, we'll watch one or two episodes. And if we're not immediately into it, we panic and we're afraid that we're going to not enjoy it and we're going to have wasted our time. And so we stop and do something else, but we'll try again.
So I got the information on the Costner-Baumgartner divorce through The Cut, Us Weekly, AP News, and People. So I'll be quoting them. But basically the backstory of their marriage, they were married for 19 years. They met at the golf course in the 90s while filming Tin Cup. The two started dating after Costner's first divorce was finalized, who he has three kids with. Kevin and Christine went on to share three children together, and she filed for divorce in May, citing irreconcilable differences. The divorce was finalized in September, and they ended up avoiding the trial that was scheduled for December. So some of the details of the divorce, I thought it would be interesting because a lot of it comes up in PNC calls and I think some of our cases. So I thought it'd be interesting to kind of detail some of the stuff and then kind of get your insight from a lawyer's perspective. But so first point, some of their money woes. Costner claimed Christine withdrew $95,000 from a shared bank account and credit cards to pay divorce attorneys and forensic accountants. And Costner stated he was forced to then limit her credit card to $30,000 a month. So wanted to hear a little bit about how it works when one spouse needs to use the shared bank accounts for attorney's fees. It comes up a lot. People are worried that someone's going to see it or that they're going to flag the charge or kind of how that works with when all of the accounts are shared.
The big deal in this one is they seem to have had a very thorough, very airtight prenup that was very, I don't know, call it what you want to. It's a contract right between two adults, but it seemed to be very favorable to him in hindsight, I guess you'd say. And that really, because those numbers, frankly, that's the same thing I hear in a say a typical Texas divorce, but I mean, like, you know, upper middle class or lower upper class people, you know, that's the same kind of numbers that in the same issues that we deal with all the time. I get that call all the time. And, you know, this is Kevin Costner. We'll get to his, you know, some of the other numbers in a minute. But it's interesting. I mean, he was running a pretty tight ship in the Costner household for financially based on what you would expect from, you know, like a major Hollywood star, in my opinion. Those are surprising numbers to me. And surprising, he must have had a provision, I guess, that said she can't pay her lawyers out of the community fund or whatever that, you know, this account is. So that's what all of that sounds like to me. I don't think anybody's actually read the prenup because it's not public. So what are your thoughts about that, Jake?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the details or why he was upset. And it is, I mean, to sort of tie it to what we see. I mean, lawyers I was having this conversation yesterday in a consult where, you know, the other side was asking for what we call interim attorney's fees in Texas, right? Where we need the judge to make orders that my spouse pays for divorce attorneys and forensic accountant. The person I was talking to is his first divorce, and he had kind of the natural questions like, why would I pay for her divorce lawyers? It's actually the situation I was talking to the client about yesterday was like, you're not paying for it. It may be physically coming from your checking account, depending on how finances are, but it's y'all paying for it. It's the community estate paying for it. And in this particular situation, it's, you know, he had the access to, this is how they did their finances. There wasn't anything wrong with it, but he just so happened to have the savings in his name and stuff. But it's community property. It's like, lawyers are going to get paid from that. And so Katie, a lot of times, is having conversations with people and in consults of, how am I going to pay for lawyers? And it's there's, to the extent that there is community funds available, it may be where a judge is telling the other side to pay for the retainer or pay for the lawyer moving forward. It may be that for the time being, you're borrowing from family or putting on credit cards. We've talked about this in other episodes, but that being a community obligation. So that, I guess that's what kind of stood out to me. But Brian's right. Maybe it was a bigger issue in this case because there's a prenup that said a lot of times you'll see prenups say that there's no interim attorney's fees that will be ordered or agreed to in a divorce. And so you'll see that in a prenup, but there's also children involved. And, you know, ultimately you cannot put in a prenup that for the safety of the children, we can't pay for lawyers or you can't ask for attorney's fees. So a lot of, you know, who knows what it was, but it is certainly a common issue from, like I said, like the case I had yesterday, kind of a younger couple going through a divorce all the way down to however you want to look at it, your celebrity divorces.
So the next point was regarding their home. Costner alleged that Baumgartner was refusing to leave their shared home, which, by the way, is worth $145 million, despite the prenup stating that she had 30 days to vacate the property following their split. According to Costner, Baumgartner was using the situation to make him comply to her financial demands. Baumgartner claimed that she had no personal income to be able to vacate her and her children out of the home, and ultimately the judge denied her request. So wanted to get your thoughts a little bit on what's enforceable, what's able to be modified in prenuptial agreements in situations like this, and kind of walk us through kind of why the judge denied that maybe.
You know, ultimately the premarital agreement, so let's say if this was in Texas, if it's enforceable, which the family code sets forth some provisions that would make it enforceable. If it's enforceable, then ultimately it is a contract, like Brian was saying, it would need to be enforced at the end of the day. Now, the judge, if it was in Texas, the judge would have the ability, maybe not have the ability to say you get a stay in the $145 million house, which I probably wouldn't want to vacate either, but the judge would have the ability to say, to make orders for temporary support, either be child support if there's kids, spousal support. I don't know what the premarital agreement said about interim spouse or temporary spousal support, but you can always have a prenup can't limit child support. There's children involved. If there's children involved, the court could just make orders for payment of bills and expenses and what have you. I mean, no judge is going to ultimately, particularly while a case is pending, going to want to kick somebody with their children out on the street. But on the flip side, that doesn't mean you get to stay in a $145 million house, particularly if the premarital agreement requires you to vacate. So that's a long way of saying generally they're enforceable. I mean, it's the conversation I know, Brian, you have when we either draft prenups or review prenups is people need to understand, assuming it checks the appropriate boxes, it's going to be enforceable. And sometimes that can be harsh. And a judge is going to have limited things what she or he can do if there's an enforceable prenup in place.
Yeah, I agree. And this is also instructive of a big difference between Texas and as far as I can tell, the other 49 states, including California, which is every other state that I'm aware of, and I know California does, has legal separation. So what that means is that, let's just say somebody files for divorce. It's a little more complicated than that. As soon as that happens, your finances are forever separate from each other. Now, that doesn't mean you don't have obligations with child support or alimony, but that's a big difference with Texas. And one of the most confusing and I think, frankly, problematic things we have in our system is that even though you might have, you're separated, maybe living in different households, there's a divorce going on. In Texas, your finances are still the same, intertwined with each other. The income that's coming in is still joint income. The expenses that are going out are still joint expenses. I mean, obviously, you have some requirements to act reasonably and not waste money and those type of things. But so I think that's what's going on here in the Costner matter is that somebody's filed for divorce and his and therefore they have no obligation toward each other, period. So she's saying, look, I can't afford to move out because I don't have any money and I didn't earn any, you know, I don't have any rights to it evidently under the prenup. And so I have to stay here. Otherwise, I'm going to be, me and my kids are going to be homeless. And I doubt that would really happen. And I'm not sure she was even quite that dramatic about it, but the judge really doesn't have a choice. As soon as we figure out the prenup is valid, then the judge has to follow it. It's a contract. And my guess is that there's probably some provision in there as well that says, you know, if you challenge this prenup, then, and you lose to her, a lot of bad things are going to happen to you, or there'll be a financial penalty, or maybe there's a, you know, a $5 million payout, but you lose it if you challenge the prenup. And so that's probably what's going on here. That's my guess about the dynamics of it. So it's similar to like there's some provisions in wills about a, it's called an ad terrorem clause that says, you know, if you challenge the will, you could be disinherited or something like that. Similar concept.
Yeah, I see that a lot in either litigating over prenups or people coming in for a divorce and they have them, or if we're drafting them or reviewing them. I always refer to the poison pill, right? It says, if you challenge it, you could pay attorney's fees, you could lose out on financial benefits or what have you, trying to obviously disincentivize people to fight about it if you're the one, you know, asking for the prenup or seeking to be enforced. And that's a good point too, Brian, about that is a constant conversation we're having with people is in Texas. And I think you're right. My understanding is it is fairly unique. We, until you're divorced, either you go to mediation and you sign a mediated settlement agreement or a judge says you're divorced, it's just, you're still married, your finances are just as if you had never separated. And so there's sometimes a motivation if you're the non-income earning spouse to drag out a divorce, right? If my spouse is making $2 million a year and I have no income, and let's assume, hopefully we're not burning through all that $2 million through our spending, then I'm motivated, frankly, to kind of drag my feet a little bit on the divorce. And so that's, we get that on kind of both ends. And sometimes you have clients that come in that, you know, frankly, their law firm or the lawyers working for them are just not moving at the speed that they want. I know Katie gets lots of those calls. That just says, I filed and a year later, I'm still married and I can't get anybody to respond to me and I can't get anybody to move this case forward. And I understand it's a long process as is, but this is getting a little ridiculous, particularly because it's kind of hard to go to work every single day when you're going through a divorce, knowing that at least 50% of your paycheck is not yours, kind of decreases motivation sometimes. So we get those calls and probably some of those dynamics playing out here too.
Next point is regarding child support. Baumgartner asked for $248,000 a month in child support, claiming Costner was making $1.5 million a month from Yellowstone. Costner came back and said he was making less in 2023 due to no longer being under contract with the show. Baumgartner's lawyers cited the family code that Kevin Costner should pay sufficient child support so that children can continue to have comparable lives when they are with their father and their mother. So basically vacations, private aircrafts and things like that. So wanted to hear a little bit about how child support is kind of calculated in Texas and also a little bit more about that comparable lifestyle situation if you guys have dealt with that.
$1.5 million a month in California after state income taxes is less. It's about $700,000 because it's over 50% right marginal tax rate. So It's actually about 30% of his net income, which is about what you'd pay 30% for three kids in Texas. So that's the guideline amount, with the very big difference, which is that we have a cap in Texas that, it, generally speaking, with very few exceptions, it's essentially capped at somebody making $150,000 a year. So you're looking at about $2,300 or $2,500, something in that range, depending on how much you end up paying out of pocket for health insurance and those type of things for three kids, versus literally 100 times that, if I'm doing my math right. So because there's no cap, evidently, in California. And so it's not clear from that what the actual ruling was. It sounds like that's the ask, and I'm not sure what the ruling was. Maybe they ultimately settled that part of it. I'm not exactly sure.
They did not settle for what she asked for.
Yeah, I mean, probably that's typical litigation, right? Somebody asked for a big number, somebody counters at a lower number, and there's often a settlement somewhere in between the two numbers. So that's the cap issue, which is, again, a big difference in Texas. From what I've seen in most states, everybody calculates a little different in each state, but for average American people, the outcome is usually the same, but fairly similar between the states. But this is a classic example of Texas being very, very different than California. Jake, I'll let you comment on the second part of it about the kind of the standard of how they come up with that number about this comparable lifestyle thing.
Yeah, you're not going to see those words in the Texas Family Code about comparable lifestyle. It's the Family Code's pretty simplistic on the family. How we do child support, which says we look at monthly net resources and we apply the percentages. So we hear people say guideline child support. That's what they're talking about, is there are guidelines in the Texas Family Code. It doesn't say anything about we're trying to maintain lifestyles. It doesn't say anything about we're trying to keep the two households equal in the way they raise the children. It's just, here's the guidelines. And like you're saying, Brian, the biggest thing being the cap, right? If that could particularly affect difference in households, so they're being comparable households, because if one spouse is making, you know, $1 million a year, but paying, you know, caps out around, well, it's $9,200 a month net resources, which you, you know, like you were saying, Brian, make around $150,000 a year is when you hit cap. So I'm paying child support, you know, as if I was making $150,000 a year, but I'm actually making $1 million, $2 million, $3 million, $500,000, what have you. There will be a significant difference in the households. Now, there are exceptions where the court can go above guidelines, but they're rare. And some of them, some counties, just you'll never see a judge go above cap. And some counties, you'll see judges try to push above it when appropriate. But it's never going to be anywhere close to what California is or some other states. It's just, it's one of those conversations you have to have with clients. Sometimes it's a hard conversation if you're telling somebody who's going to be receiving child support, and you have to help them plan financially and talk about other ways we can kind of recover or take care of them financially through the divorce. And unfortunately, Brian, or sometimes in the situation, or fortunately, depends on how you look at it, I guess, saying, I didn't write this, right? It's like, I tell people all the time, it's like, I can see the state capitol from my office window. I don't work there, right? I didn't write it. And that's our job, is to work within a judge's job, to work within the confines of what's in the Texas Family Code. And we got to have really kind of frank discussions about people, what that looks like. And the last thing I guess I'll say on this too, though, is you can always do more, right? The caps are what they are. Some clients, they want to do above guideline child support. Some of them want to structure it differently with, maybe it's not child support, but there's some things that we agree to pay and cover. It's all a discussion that needs to be had whenever you're talking about child support and what the two different households look like moving forward from a divorce.
I will wrap up a little bit, and this isn't so much of a legal question, but you guys take potential new client consults so much, and this comes up just even my intake calls. So wanted to get your thoughts. There was a point of contention a little bit in this divorce. Baumgartner alleged that Costner told the kids about the divorce on his own terms via a Zoom call when they had requested to do it together in person. So wanted to see, do clients ever ask you any advice on talking about the subject with their children? I know we've had a couple episodes specifically with Amy Tyson, who's an author who has a book kind of on talking to your kids about it, but just wanted to kind of close out and wrap it up with what your thoughts were on there and what you tell clients.
Yeah, I get asked that a lot. I know you do too, Brian. And I mean, it's not a legal question, but people are looking to us for guidance through a divorce or a custody case. And I always tell people, I'm not a mental health professional, but obviously I see a lot of this having been through a divorce and obviously deal with my clients' divorces over the years. If there's a mental health professional involved in the family, or a counselor, a pastor, maybe family therapist, whatever that's you can reach out to and get guidance from. I always encourage people to do that because it's a personal decision. There's no legally correct answer of what you do and how you tell your children that you're going through a divorce. What I tell people though is it's, you know, you may be very anxious about the conversation, but I do try to let people know that my experience is that, and what I hear from mental health professionals is that, you know, being on the same page with kids and making sure that they understand that both their parents love them. I mean, no matter what's going on with the family unit or how much you're upset with your spouse right now or the other parent of your child, it's never the child's fault. And the parents still love the child very much. And so I encourage them to keep that in mind and try to keep the children away from whatever drama we adults are having. And then if there's a mental health professional that they have involved in their lives so that they can get involved in their lives, I think that's a good conversation to have with that individual about the actual timing and method of telling the children. Well, that's what we have for today. That was fun. And this is our first episode on our ongoing pop culture series. So be on the lookout for more episodes like this. If there's a topic that you'd like to discuss, please email us at podcast@waltersgilbert.com. We're always looking for feedback and suggestions and follow-up questions. If you have anything you need from the firm or have additional questions or topics you want to discuss, you can also find us on our website and you can find the firm's contact information there. So we welcome all feedback. We welcome y'all's involvement in this podcast, and we appreciate everything we get from our listeners. So thanks for listening, and we'll see y'all next time.
For information about the topics covered in today's episode and more, you can visit our website at waltersgilbreth.com. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of For Better, Worse, or Divorce, where we post new episodes every first and third Wednesday. Do you have a topic you want discussed or a question for our hosts? Email us at podcast@waltersgilbreth.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time.